Hello, and welcome to the Og Blog Podcast, the podcast about Peanuts books. You like us, just perhaps not in that way. Today we're doing a little bit of an interview. We've got a special guest, Robert Pope, an artist on a number of Peanuts projects, and we'll be talking to him about that and perhaps some other things. Hello, Robert.
Hello. How's it going, Matt?
Oh, it's going okay. And yourself?
It's been a good day. I've gotten a lot of drawing done. That's always a good day.
So anyway, let's find out a bit about you. What's your background as an artist?
I started as an animator, and I hold up my index and my middle finger and do the air quotes for animator because I was one of those people who sat across from the guidance counselor in about ninth grade or so and said, they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a cartoonist or something along those lines. And the question, of course, is always posed, what's your plan B? And my answer was, And obviously that meant that I better succeed. So when I got out of high school, I wasn't particularly interested in going to school for 4 years. So I took a year off and did a whole bunch of jobs. You know, I was the Richmond, Virginia's worst busboy, worst dishwasher, worst whatever, take your pick. And I moved down to Atlanta. And when it was still a two-year, more of a technical school, I went to the Art Institute here in Atlanta, largely because they offered some courses in cartooning. Of course, the minute I signed up, they jettisoned those cartooning courses. But basically, it was an effective, fundamental education so that you could go get a job at a print shop or an ad agency or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, dinosaur courses like marker comping and type specking and things like that. It was effective. It served a purpose, and you got to sniff a lot of markers and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, I'm sure you were doing drawing all along, but the technical aspects of what's needed to do the business of art, the specifics that people ask for, I'm sure that was also very useful.
It was a very effective thing to be able to cut mechanicals and do a lot of different things. I tried desperately to work an airbrush, but I was terrible at it. Which is funny because that was actually my first job out of school. I did a lot of freelancing and storyboards and marker comps and stuff like that. And I got a job at a place called Davidson & Company that was a photo retouching concern. And their number one client was a big company out of Tennessee at the time in the later 80s called Whittle Communication that did this thing called Channel One. Do you remember that? It was like education that went into classrooms.
Yeah.
But it had advertising aspects to it. And they was an enormous client, and we were constantly, you know, making these enormous prints, and there were photo retouching and airbrush and Dr. Martin dyes and stuff like that. And I was awful, just awful. And at night I was doing storyboards, and I did storyboards for this company in Atlanta called Cinema Concepts. And they had a client in Los Angeles called Pacific Theaters. They did these swap meets out at old drive-in theaters. And they had an idea where they basically said, we want to do something where we animate it and looks kind of like Archie Comics without getting, you know, sued by the Archie Comics people. And I said, well, I could do a pretty good, you know, Dan DiCarlo riff. And I did this board, and the board got sold. And all the other animators at the company were working on a big project for Delta and Disney. And this was at the tail end of production on Little Mermaid. Mm-hmm. So Los Angeles was consumed. There wasn't an animator who wasn't working on that movie, pretty much. So all other Disney business was being farmed out everywhere. So this was a big six-minute film, and they didn't have anybody to animate this Pacific Theaters thing. So the production manager of the office called me in and said, well, this board sold, and we've got no one to do it. Would you consider coming here and working for us? And I think I thought about it for about a 13th of a second, and I said, yeah, it'd be great. And there was a pause, and he said, you know how to animate, right? And I was like, yes, of course.
Of course, absolutely.
Certainly I know how to animate.
And you ride a horse, too, don't you?
Exactly. I've got two Preston Blair books I can stick under my pillow tonight, and by tomorrow morning I'll know everything about squash and stretch. What do you mean, do I know how to animate? I've watched Disney every Sunday my whole life. Of course I can. And I was not particularly good at that. I was a good cleanup artist. Mm-hmm. And mercifully, the art director at that company, the animation director, a fellow named Dave Strandquist, and the one of the other fellows who was more or less the lead animator, Clay Croker, who was the voice of Zorak and Moltar on Space Ghost, and, you know, passed away about a year and a half ago. They were incredibly supportive and kind and taught me how to animate to survive, basically, because I had always kind of seen myself as just being either a print cartoonist or a gag cartoonist. And, you know, obviously we all appreciate animation as a medium, but you can appreciate it and not know enough to survive professionally.
Yeah.
But that's actually how I started and animated pretty much since, you know, the mid to late 80s, And at one point I was doing a lot of work for Cartoon Network, and I was actually working with Clay on Space Ghost Coast to Coast, in the earliest iterations of Adult Swim, and I was animating for him and helping along, and Heidi McDonald was editing all of the all-ages titles for DC, and she called down, I think, and spoke to Clay directly and said, well, we're going to be doing a Space Ghost Coast to Coast comic book. Would you like to draw it? And Clay, of course, said, yeah, and then he hung up the phone, and it suddenly occurred to him that he liked the idea of drawing it, but the actual execution and the amount of energy involved. So he immediately called me up and said, hey, you want to do a comic book with me? And I said, yeah, sure. What am I supposed to say? No.
No, of course. So you were those evil people who, when Cartoon Network ended up in DC's hands, you pulled the work away from those of us who had been doing Flintstones and Jetsons over for when Archie was publishing them.
But, you know, it's funny. I at one point in time, there were so many all-ages titles between the DC stuff and some of the, like, when Marvel sort of took over that Starline business, when they took the Archie titles and they had Heathcliff and all that other stuff. And, you know, I guess I regret I never got to draw Jackie Jokers, but, you know, I'll live.
Oh.
So,
everybody's favorite Harvey stand-up comedian comic book. Absolutely.
One of my big heroes has always been Ernie Colon. I always thought that his iteration or his version of Richie was, to me, the best. It was the most action-oriented. It was the most European.
It was only when I was older and got to see a lot of Ernie's stuff that I realized, oh, those Richie Riches I was reading when I was younger, that was clearly him. It's got his eyeballs, it got stuff. I was lucky enough to get to know Ernie for a while, and talented guy. We talked about doing products together. Never happened. Oh.
You know, there's so many of those things that kind of come like that and then sort of just fade off into the ether. But I did always like Clay always thought it was amusing that in his Richie Rich comics, you could always tell that he was involved, because at some point in time there might be a spy that would be shooting at Richie with a machine gun, which didn't tend to happen in Warren's books or any of the other guys that were drawing Richie. So, anyway, to make a long story even longer, I helped Clay out. And the more I helped Clay out, the less interest he had in actually participating.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he, by the third issue, he just kind of wanted to write and sort of do a little layout stuff and do the cover. The cover was incredibly important to him. And so I ended up, I think the third or fourth Space Ghost issue, I think I did two stories, and it was the first time I'd ever done a full 22-page comic book. And this, of course, was just the most exciting thing in the world. But you can kind of see the whole thing winding down. And so by that point, Heidi was gone and Joan Hilty was editing the books. So I called up Joan and I said, you know, this is great. I'd like to do some more stuff. And she said, well, what can you draw? And I said, well, what do you got? And she said, we're going to try Scooby-Doo. And so I tried out for Scooby-Doo. I think they gave me some sort of I can't even remember the test page. But they liked what I did with Scooby-Doo, and so I started drawing that. And I think there was a rotation of two or three other people. The whole thing took on kind of a musical chairs feeling as the number of titles shrunk.
Mm-hmm.
It was me and Joe Staton and a few other folks, and we, you know, sort of traded it around. Sometimes I did covers, sometimes I did interiors. And it was a lot of fun. And along the way, I had been animating for Cartoon Network, you know, I could do Johnny Bravo, and I could do Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy, and Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends, and Ed, Edd n Eddy, and all that sort of stuff. So it was a big roster of stuff, but it was absolutely, totally, you know, inside the DC house.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, you know, I started trying to branch out and do other things, and along the way, I had but one of the original editors of the book. The fellow that I dealt with was Alex Gaylor, who's a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of fun with him. Alex is great. And he knows Atlanta real well. And we had a mutual affection with regard to David Hyde Pierce. So,
excuse me, I'm going to pause for a second because I left my phone on and it is ringing and it stopped. Okay. All right. Very good.
It might have been David Hyde Pierce.
It could have been. I always miss his calls, you know.
Well, he's a busy man, you know, Broadway and all that sort of stuff. Alex and I floated an idea by him one time that hadn't occurred to him, but I had always thought that Niles Crane struck me as kind of an adult Linus.
That's an interesting take.
If you think about it, I mean, there's a certain amount of gentleness and neuroses there.
Mm.
But at any rate.
And a certain competence and incompetence
exactly.
at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's also one particular episode where he's frightened by a bug or something when he's, you know, bringing wood into a cabin, and it reminded me of that Sunday with Linus and Lucy.
The spider on the log. Yeah.
I wonder if Abe Lincoln was afraid of spiders or whatever the joke is. So at any rate, I sent these samples off, and I never heard back. You know, and you know as well as anybody else, that's not particularly unusual.
Yeah. They get big piles of stuff, and going through samples is the lowest priority because they have to get today's book out, and they've got their three people they're working with.
Exactly. It just doesn't go like that.
Yeah.
So time passed, and I kind of just got back to whatever else I was doing. And one day I was over at Stephanie Gladden's house, and she was showing me some stuff. She said, "Oh, I'm doing this story for the Boom Peanuts comic book."
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, I think it might have been a story you wrote.
Oh, okay. The good one.
The one with the rerun where he's lamenting the fact that he's basically, you know, wearing all Linus's old clothes.
Yes. That would be one of mine, yes.
Yeah. And at any rate, so Steph shows me these things. And, you know, Steph is like 3 zillion times better artist than I am.
I won't say that, but she is a very, very talented lady.
She's worked for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
She can draw darn near anything. And her facility, her technique, you know, she's one of those people that you kind of learn from by osmosis, largely. And I've always found working around her, as I have off and on many times, to be rewarding and intimidating at the same time. Which is true of a lot of the people that I've worked with. I think it's wonderful to try to up your game around a lot of really good people.
It's a good place to be. And Stephanie, I was thrilled when I got to work with Stephanie because I loved her stuff going back to Hopster's Tracks, at least.
Oh, Hopster's Tracks, and her Simpsons comics and the stuff she's done with the Looney Tunes characters, and SpongeBob, and, you know, you did the Ren and Stimpy comics that she did for Marvel back in the day. You know, glorious stuff, marvelous talent. And so at any rate, I go over there and Steph shows me this. And, of course, my reaction is, of course, to just be, you know, blown away by the quality of the artwork,
mm-hmm.
but also slightly like, oh, wait a minute, that's what I'm supposed to be doing, you know. So,
I'm going to pause you here just because does Peanuts have a place in your background? Is there something that makes you particularly want to do Peanuts?
Good question. There are about 3 zillion things that are graphically influencing to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think by and large, many of us that share the same interests could look back and say, okay, well, I was affected by, you know, Jack Kirby, Marvel Comics, is the FF, the first 100 issues of the FF, or I was a big nut for Carl Barks' Donald Duck and enjoy Don Rose's modern take on it and stuff like that. I could say that I like certain things in cinema, and I liked reading the comic book pages. But Peanuts is deeper than that. There's probably not a day goes by that I don't pick up a Peanuts book and thumb through it. It doesn't even matter which book it is. I just pick one up. And it could be like a dog-eared Peanuts Parade book. Those were revelatory when they came out because up to that point you had all of the old Fawcett Crest paperbacks where they would do things like they would extend the left and right sides of the panels just to kind of make them fit in that irregular higgledy-piggledy way that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I always found that kind of fascinating, but the first time I ever got to see those parade books, the reproductions were so big and started to see more of the detail and inking and stuff. I guess I'm spiraling out of control here, but Peanuts is certainly the most important cartoon. I detest saying cartoon. I mean, as far as a comic strip is concerned, or as far as what it meant in the animated medium, it's just extremely important to me and has a very deep emotional place.
Okay.
Much more so than just saying this is. I mean, if you asked me to rattle off five or six of my favorite comic strips, you know, I would have to do it by decade.
Right.
I think probably the greatest comic strip of the 80s, in my opinion, frankly, is Bloom County.
Okay, Burke Breathitt, yeah.
I would get the paper, and the first three things I would read in the 80s every morning were Peanuts, Bloom County, and Farside. And you get a little further into the 80s, and, you know, you get to Calvin and Hobbes. And I still consider Garfield more of a 70s strip than an 80s strip.
It started in the 70s, although by the 80s it changed when certain assistants came into the production of that. But it changed in texture.
I always thought the first three or so years of that strip were really good stuff. Laugh out loud, funny in places. I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
But Peanuts is just one of those things where it was sort of an ever-present part of your life. It's not just a comic strip. And it's not just an animated show, and it's not just a little figurine that you got at Hallmark or things like that, or a Christmas ornament or whatever. It's just kind of filters in. It infiltrates every part of your life and every bit of your thinking. And, you know, unfortunately, I've got, you know, whole reams of strips memorized. And I say unfortunately because at a certain point in your high school years, you know, you got to set that stuff aside, or you're never going to go out on a date with a girl.
But you did eventually go on a date with a girl, I suspect. Eventually.
Oh, yeah. That worked out pretty good. But it's very hard to come up with a snappy or condensed answer about what Peanuts means without sounding kind of like you're obsessed with it. But on the other hand, how can I put this? Here's one of the best example of what Peanuts means to me is on Mother's Day of 1974. Mother's Day of 1974, the house that we were living in Somerville, South Carolina, was demolished by a tornado while we were in the house.
Ooh.
At about 5 o'clock in the morning. So the roof was torn off and all this sort of stuff, and everyone is, you know, the neighbors are coming to help, and the Red Cross is coming, and we went across the street to the neighbor's house. Everyone, of course, is in shock. And I'm not necessarily certain that at 7 years of age you really process what just happened. But obviously it's a huge trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, your house just fell down, basically. And we went over to the neighbor's house, and everyone is standing around in their pajamas. And I look and I notice on the coffee table next to the sofa, there is a hardback copy of Peanuts Classics.
Ooh.
Which, at that time, I had never seen. And I sat on the floor and read that thing, absorbed the... And then made it my life's pursuit to find a hardback copy. So I was absolutely... You know, all the events of that morning were suddenly melted away because there was a Peanuts book I'd never seen before. And if that doesn't show serious mental problems, I'm not sure what does.
Okay, so now we see Peanuts has informed your life, and we pick up our story back when you are staring at Stephanie Gladden going, "You've got my job."
You've got my job. How did you do that? So, of course, I came back here, and I put the same samples back together, and I emailed sort of blindly, and Alex Gaylor emailed me back. And I said, well, you know, I was just kind of curious. And at that point, I was looking more for constructive criticism than anything else. Where did I go wrong? Or what was not in my sample that was in other people's samples? And the reaction was, we never saw your stuff. What do you mean you never saw my stuff? We never got a package from you. And I still to this day don't know whether it was just discarded or at the bottom of the pile or ended up in a birdcage or what happened. But I sent the samples back again, and Alex said, oh, this is fine. We'd love to give you a story. And 2 seconds later, I had, I think it was a two-pager that ends up with Lucy punching Linus, which couldn't have gone any better, frankly. That was perfect. And then I just, that kind of blossomed. And the more I did of that, the more I wanted and started taking on longer stories. And I enjoyed the, you know, one of the interesting things, you know, perfectly well, one of the interesting things about these modern adaptations is the idea that you're taking storylines. Some, of course, some of the storylines were original storylines, but the lion's share of them were extrapolations of the strip or compressions of different sequences of strips with slightly new bridging material.
Right, and especially later in the boom run, they were specifically aiming for that.
Yeah, and the ready-to-read series that I've been doing and having a ball with for Simon & Schuster is exactly the same way. And the fun for me is to take something, like one of the books I'm working on right now, which I'm inking right now, is called Nice to Meet You, Franklin. And it's basically a retelling of the meeting at the beach with Charlie Brown and Franklin. And then Franklin coming over to the neighborhood and meeting all the characters and then kind of being put off by what a kook Linus turns out to be with the great pumpkin stuff.
Right.
And then there's a little happy resolution at the end.
But yeah, basically the first two Franklin storylines right there, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, the real challenge there is to tell it without basically just frame for frame copying over the images that have already been done. And I think that's extremely important in terms of, you know, because otherwise it might as well just be Photoshop.
Right, right. And you know that if Schultz were alive and was doing that storybook, he would be making different choices because of the different format. You know
exactly. And it's sort of like the I always point towards the story picture book for Charlie Brown's All-Stars, the one that Sparky illustrated
yes.
Personally.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that are different there that aren't in the actual show. And that's exactly what I was thinking, is to try to do something that was correctly, you know, it tells the story, but it doesn't go, okay, well, that's the exact same panel in the strip, you know.
Yeah.
And the very important panel where Linus is shaking hands with Franklin, I didn't just want to repeat that particularly. Also, in this particular adaptation I'm working on, Charlie Brown shakes Franklin's hand earlier in the story when they meet at the beach. So it felt kind of redundant. I had to come up with another visual.
Okay,
that
makes sense.
For that, so that it wasn't so such a rehashing.
But speaking of Franklin, something I did want to bring up because I just thought about this the other day. You and I did a Franklin story together for the comic book.
New Shoe Zoom,
absolutely. And this was before what you're working on now is, I believe, the second Franklin in the title book that the Ready to Read.
The other one was a hockey title, right?
Yes, the other one was a hockey title. And I think you and I may have done the first outside the strip Franklin lead story.
You're probably right. I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, you're probably right. That was a fun story. I liked that a lot.
Yeah, well, it was fun writing it, and then you did a very lovely job of giving it the energy that...
Did you ever see the original finished inks before they were colored?
I don't believe I did.
I did something very interesting, and nobody said, you know, not to do it, and I understood why there was a change made. But in trying to make it look totally correct, I inked Franklin with the little lines across his skin indicating a darker skin tone.
Yes.
And obviously, in retrospect, I should have run that by Lex before I did, because somebody went to the trouble of having to take all of those out, because it didn't fit consistently with the modern interpretation of not just the animated features, but the way that Franklin would be managed in the strip now.
Right. Well, also Franklin's original appearances were in dailies, and went back before they were coloring dailies.
Sure.
So you did that. But also you find with almost any black characters in strip from the time that at the very least the lines decreased, they lightened up. And it hadn't happened with Franklin, although it always seemed to me it was more not so much making him less black as just making his facial features stand out more.
Well, and also I think perhaps as the strip continued to shrink, I think Sparky knew perfectly well that too much hatching across the face would just turn into mud. It wouldn't have worked. And then, of course, later on, he turned it over to the Zipitone.
Yes, later in the run. Now, you're talking about inks. Are you doing physical artwork on these Peanuts products, or have you switched to digital?
I am. You know, it's funny because, you know, like how I said, it's funny. Like, there might be something funny here, but there's probably not. It's an interesting challenge because the stuff that I did for the Boom comic books, I inked with whatever floated my boat at the time. Usually it was a combination of Micron pens and Sumi brush markers, just because in animation that's typically what I would use and had been using in my DC work for many years. But when I started the ready-to-read books for Simon & Schuster, I went from, you know, 8 or 9 pages with 6 or 7 illustrations per page to a 32 or 24-page book that had 1 illustration per page. So I was able to lavish a lot more attention on those illustrations. And the bigger the illustrations got, frankly, the more cracks in the armor showed up in terms of deficiencies and where I did a good job and where I didn't do a good job. So I began to work a lot harder to try to make things look as accurate as they could in terms of, you know, 1965 or 1966 style of illustration. And that required me switching over to the Esterbrook 914 radio nib and inking it totally old school.
Serious nib. Okay, great.
Oh, yeah. And I find that to be the most wonderful opportunity and expression. And, you know, of course, every cartoonist always has said the same thing. You know, it's not necessarily the tool. It's the thinking process that goes on in your head and how it gets onto the paper. But in this case, when I'm trying so hard to mimic the snap in Sparky's line or some of the things that he did with rain or little blobs or shapes, like the way that little bushes are drawn and puffs of smoke or whatever, that no, you need that specific tool or it doesn't quite come out right.
Right. You need the way the line varies with the weight of your hand, because it needs, yeah, I can definitely see that in some of the things you mentioned.
Well, and it's a fascinating thing, too, because every cartoonist has a different kind of, you know, the great Mad Magazine cartoonist, Paul Coker Jr., who did all those wonderful specials for Rankin Bass and designed all those characters. You know, you look at his Mad Magazine illustrations or his greeting card work, and he's got this incredible, you know, bear down, lift up, scratch, scratch thing. And it's semi-angular, but you can tell he's working with a hunt or a speedball quill that can really take that kind of pressure. And bearing down just almost to the point where the nib is going to snap and lifting up and down. But that's not the way that Sparky applied ink on the paper. I mean, his is so much more delicate, and the ink just kind of oozes off of that nib and flows out. So, you know, it's an interesting mental challenge to get into that mindset when you're starting to do that. Also, of course, because one of the things that hopefully no one notices, because I'm trying hard to make sure that it's not too obvious, is in this modern iteration, when I do one of these books, you know, obviously it goes through many hands for approval, the Simon & Schuster designers and editors, and then, you know, my pals out at Creative Services, and then some folks at, you know, who knows, I'm not even sure how many people look at it anymore, but in order for all that to get approved to go to ink, the pencils have to be really, really tight. Well, that's obviously not the way Sparky worked. He barely put in any pencil work at all.
Mm-hmm.
All of the expression and everything occurred in the ink stage, and to a certain extent, a lot of guys like Steve Ditko's Spider-Man was that way. You know, there were almost no pencils to speak of. Same thing with Carl Barks's Uncle Scrooge and stuff like that.
Yeah, you got basically layouts going there, and a few circles showing where people are, but yeah.
But it is darn difficult to get something approved that is model correct and pencil in the pencil stage that is very tight, and then go back over it and create any sense of snap or spontaneity in the ink line. And I consider that maybe the most difficult thing to do, to not have it all die in the ink stage, to keep the ink kind of joyful and snappy and energetic. And not mechanical, not just tracing over the pencils.
So anyway, the ready-to-read books, how did you get on that gig? Was that something, did you pitch them, or did somebody at creative associates maybe suggest, hey, here's somebody who's doing a good job on the comics, or what?
It was, to my recollection, and I say it like that, to my recollection, the Boom business was starting to slow down. And very clearly that was not going to carry on forever. And I was interested in just getting into other things. So I'm pretty sure I just called up Lex or emailed him and said, you know, it'd be great if I could do some other stuff. What's going on? Is there anything that I can help out with? And I think he presented that to me and said, you want to try to do some of this stuff? And then I said yes, and he forwarded some of my work to the Simon & Schuster folks' attention. And then sometime later, one of the designers. And typically, with that, in that situation, I don't work as much with the editor as I work with the designer. The designer will get the galleys together and lay out where the type is going to go, and then they'll send me the whole shebang, and then I'll start drawing. So usually, and they'll make some art suggestions, little notes about what strip they're kind of speaking to or referencing, and then I'll go from there. But, yeah, I think that Simon & Schuster stuff occurred because I had gotten back to Lex and was just looking for different things to do, and it's turned out to be a really enjoyable, wonderful stuff.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad it's going well for you. I really should have – I realize I forgot to at the top of the broadcast give the disclaimer that you've actually worked with me outside of the Peanuts realm. I've actually hired you on as a freelancer on a project or two.
That is
so, and you did some beautiful work even when you weren't doing somebody else's characters.
Hey, that was fun. Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. The superhero stuff was always one of my favorite things. Like I mentioned earlier, Jack Kirby was a big influence.
Yeah.
Ditko, obviously, John Romita Sr., Buscema, a million people that I could crank off names, Gil Kane, and on the DC side, I always loved Carmine Infantino's
work. How did I know you were about to go to there? Yeah, Carmine.
Because it's quirky. It's really, you know, all those guys, whether or not they had, no matter what, their success is in the fact that it's, no matter how it's managed, you look at it and you go, well, that's so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at a Gil Kane drawing. It doesn't matter who inks it or how, what kind of meat grinder it goes through. But you look at the staging, you look at the way that the figure has a certain mannequin-like quality. There's always a shot where you're looking straight up the nostrils or the nose. You know, the way that the very angular, aggressive jaws are drawn and the way that the bodies are splayed out, and you go, that's Gil Kane. You know, you look at Kirby stuff, and you go, well, it's Kirby. And the way that Carmine Infantino drew people running, there's a human being in the world runs like that. But it was effective. It had a great sense of design and stuff like that. And it's immediately recognizable, and it has a personality to it. And beyond that, it's influenced other people. You know, we all know for a fact that there is no person in the history of Western civilization who has ever leaned back and thrown a baseball the way that Charlie Brown cocks back on one leg.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way that you think of someone leaning back and throwing a baseball, and the way that the gloves go on the hands, and so many of the graphic elements that don't have any real grounding in reality, but it doesn't matter. It is its own reality. That's what's exciting for me, is to be able to do that. But what I was driving at was one of the jobs that I did that turned out to be a lot of fun when I was working at D.C., was for a while there they had an animated show called Batman the Brave and the Bold, which was done in a style that sort of spoke to the Batman artist Dick Sprang in the 50s.
Okay.
Big barrel-chested kind of Batman. And this was an extreme simplification and a slightly more lighthearted approach than iterations that had come before, including the Bruce Timm stuff. And DC did a comic book version of it, and I got to do a good many number of issues of it. And so for a while there, I was doing slightly cartoony but straight superhero stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And you're getting to work with a lot of characters, because Brave and the Bold was a crossover series. There's always...
Yeah, it was sort of like Marvel team-up every month or whatever. But so I ended up doing an issue with The Flash, and I did the cover. And the first thing I did in the cover was make sure that I staged it so there was Carmine Infantino cityscape in the back. Those just little checkerboard buildings that where the entire city seemed like it was about 40 miles in the back, and they're just running out in the middle of nowhere. And I just thought that was a work like that in the future because it was uniquely cartoonish,
mm-hmm.
and that's not necessarily what's
in demand.
That's not exactly what you call it. It's not the major seller.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you got, you know, Bruce Timm has said many times, I'd love to work in mainstream comics, but there's no work for me. And if there's no work for Bruce Timm in mainstream comics, you know,
yeah.
who am I?
No.
You know, so.
But they don't even do the, it used to be there would be a book with the name Adventures at the end of it, which would be the,
yeah.
you know, the based on the animated version. I was always disappointed when they called the TV show Static Shock rather than calling it Static, which was the original Milestone comic book series, just because I wanted there to be a comic book on the stands called Static Adventures.
Yeah. Well, that would have been great. That would have been great. Was that John Rosen? Was the writer on that? Right?
I don't know who worked on the anime. The comic book was Dwayne McDuffie and Robert Washington III, both of whom have unfortunately passed on since.
Yeah, and I think like I was just thinking of John. I think he may have done some of that stuff. He did a book for DC called Zombie, but he also wrote a boatload of Scooby Doo for.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Well, Scooby-Doo has an interesting set of regulars. And also, just the sheer quantity of Scooby-Doo comics just always, I mean, they're still running two titles of Scooby-Doo at this point.
It's fascinating. I drew Scooby-Doo for years, and then I just, you know, I mean, there's a certain situation where specific people or approvals folks think that you're fine and you're on model, and then someone else wanders in and looks at it and goes, this sucks, go away. And that was kind of what happened with my Scooby-Doo stuff. I sort of got phased out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was largely due to the more that DC became a part of Warner Brothers, the more influential the Warner Brothers licensing people became in the way that the comic books were managed and what was approved. And it went from, you know, having a lot more quirky or autonomous or independent creators like Joe Staton or people like that who drew Scooby-Doo for years and years but drew it in his own style.
Yeah.
And it was marvelous, marvelous, acceptable stuff. And then all of a sudden it was like, no, it needs to look just like the model sheet or you're kicked to the curb.
Yeah, and that's got to be both tough and less interesting. I mean, the less you can bring yourself to it.
Well, it was perfectly fine for me for a while because since I'd started in animation, that was always my goal anyway.
Okay.
Was suppression of the, you know, my goal was the suppression of the individual style. And that sounds terrible said that way, but that was my job, was to take the model sheets that I was handed and make sure that nobody knew that anybody else did
mm-hmm.
it.
Oh.
And yes, there are intrinsic characteristics to every animator that are so obvious, but to the, you know, layperson, you know, probably not. I mean, you know, otherwise you'd never have all those specials cobbled together in the 70s on CBS where they'd cut from a Chuck Jones Bugs Bunny to a Bob McKimson Bugs Bunny to a Friz Freleng Bugs Bunny and back and forth and see all the different changes in shape and dimension and volume. But, you know, I would mention these sorts of things to friends or my father, and they were like, what, it's Bugs Bunny? It's Bugs Bunny all the way through. And it would drive me insane that no one else seemed to be able to see that it was three different versions of Bugs Bunny drawn over, you know, two different decades by half a dozen different people. But, you know, these sorts of things are why we got into this business, and some people are just, you know, enjoy it without, you know, losing their mind. But regarding Scooby-Doo, I had always considered myself really good at staying on model, and at a certain point, it was the sort of thing where it's like, well, it's not on model enough. And I was thinking, well, I'm tracing the model sheets. How much more on model can it get? And that was the end of that. I still do Looney Tunes work for DC, and that's a lot of fun. Those characters are near and dear. They certainly don't have the emotional pull of Charlie Brown and Snoopy, but they are obviously something that's part of your life, part of your childhood, and you did see them also on a very nearly daily basis, afternoon cartoons and Saturday mornings and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kids today have too much variety, too many things to choose from. When you have to watch the exact same Bugs Bunny cartoon three times a week, that really builds character.
I think it all comes down, and this, of course, is this particular, I wouldn't say rant, but this particular observation has been made by many people, and there's nothing original about it, but one of the things that certainly knit our society together for many, many years was that you really only had about four good choices, five if you include PBS.
Mm-hmm.
You get your three biggies, you got one lousy UHF station, if you're lucky, and then you've got PBS. So on any given rainy Saturday afternoon, even if you didn't like Westerns, if the only thing that was on was Gunsmoke, you were probably going to watch Gunsmoke. And if you didn't like Bowling for Dollars, but it was all that was on, you watched Bowling for Dollars. Or, you know, Godzilla movies, or, you know, Stanley Kramer's It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, or whatever. And you knew that, generally speaking, by and large, most of the other people in your town were probably watching the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just reflecting on this in that, you know, now we've got not only tons of stations, but you're not watching live, you're watching streaming, you could be watching The West Wing now from a decade and a half ago or whatever, and the odds of you actually watching the same thing as the guy sitting next to you did last night are a lot slimmer. I counter that with the fact that movies, it used to be movies would go slowly through theaters, and so even if you watch the same movie as somebody else, you probably didn't watch it on the same weekend. But now everything is so front-loaded that odds are, if you saw a movie last weekend, there's probably one of two movies that you saw. There, you know, the 50% of the movie tickets went to two movies. And because of that, they're now what you have in common, and TV not so.
Yeah, between that and what I've tried to describe to my children, the panic of missing a holiday special and realizing you had 364 days to wait for it to show back up. And otherwise, you know, the idea that – and also if you happen there to be a new special on,
mm-hmm.
and you wanted to watch it and you missed it for whatever, you know, reason, that the idea that it might never come back on.
Yeah, that
– some of the more
– that the Nanny Christmas special I have never seen again. Oi to the world.
Wow, well, there's that. I was thinking more about the last time that I saw You're in Love, Charlie Brown broadcast, and then I was like, wow, I wonder if that's ever coming back. And it only came back by way of VHS tape.
Mm-hmm.
I actually invested in one of the most harebrained video replay setups in the world because I was one of the 500,000 people who wandered into a store and said, yes, I'd like to buy a RCA Selectivision CED video disc player. And the reason was is that they had two or three Peanuts discs that had four specials each on them, and they were obscurity stuff. You're in Love, There's No Time for Love, It's a Mystery,
mm-hmm.
All Stars, which I hadn't seen in years.
Yeah, and All Stars is a lovely one.
All Stars is, Clay used to say this, and I always agreed, All Stars is arguably the closest to a strip animated of any of the specials.
Mm-hmm.
It really is so much like the strip in so many ways, and more so than maybe even Pumpkin. It has the most maudlin ending in the world. I mean, it's just absolutely the most depressing little ending as they pull back while they're, you know, standing out in the rain. And correctly, that's the way it should be,
mm-hmm.
Because it has so much wonderful emotional punch. I think some of the best specials in the 70s are also the ones that have an absolutely stark ending. The Valentine special from the 70s ends with absolutely nobody happy. You know, Schroeder is, you know, crestfallen because he stood up for Charlie Brown, and you know, you saw what that got him. And Linus is depressed because Miss Othmar goes off with the boyfriend. And, you know, Charlie Brown is delusional about needing two briefcases next year for all of his Valentines. And it's far and away, there's no happy ending there.
Yeah, I miss that in a lot of the, including in the kids' storybooks, which I understand doing kids' storybooks, or the Peanuts movie, is the need they felt to give it a happy ending, which is not to say they never got a legitimately happy ending in the earlier stuff. Obviously, Charlie Brown Christmas has a happy ending.
Yeah, and there are ones that have endings that are not necessarily happy, but are, for lack of a better term, villain enough, mm-hmm. and they kind of spiral. You know, the ending of the ending of Pumpkin is farcical and funny because Linus is ranting as they pull away from the wall. So it's not necessarily a sad ending, but it somehow manages to be up-tempo. I sort of put it in the same category as The Honeymooners, where, you know, in the course of the classic 39, there are very few of those that end on a happy note.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes they end in a note that is very kind of spiraling out of control, like the end of Better Living Through Television, where they go to sell the happy housewife helper or whatever, and it all comes to pot, and Ralph falls and knocks over the set, and basically the whole thing ends with Norton yelling to the camera, and now back to Charlie Chan. So it's you know that it ended badly, but it's still a funny bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly get why that's, you know, not necessarily where they're going with a storybook that's relevant for maybe a kindergartner or a first grader. And that's, you know, perfectly understandable. And also, I don't particularly mind that because if you're looking for the real depth charge, the real unvarnished deep stuff, then you have many opportunities to pick the strip books up.
Absolutely.
And see exactly how that plays out and how, you know, you go back and look at Sparky Stuff and you realize how infrequently he used the word love. It reminds me of a story about Bing Crosby, who was very, very concerned about making sure that the songs that he sang in the early part of his career did not delve into too much of a saccharine tendencies. And so he would, if you go back to his earlier catalog, you will never find a song where he sings the words, "I love you," because he thought that that was just laying it on too thick. And, you know, Sparky, generally speaking, uses the phrase, "I like you." There's a lot of like, you know, mm-hmm. and he's talking about how his dad, you know, how Charlie Brown's talking about when he goes to his father's barbershop and his father will always take time to turn and smile and you know, that's because he likes me. Or Peppermint Patty gets the flowers from her father and Charlie Brown says, "Your dad likes you." But when he does use the word love, how incredibly, you know, laser precise that is. And probably the most obvious is the Sunday page where Lucy is ranting about how lousy her life is. And she says, "Count my blessings. Ha, I can count my blessings on one finger," or whatever she says. And it all builds up to that marvelous tiny little panel where Linus says, "Well, you have a little brother who loves you." And then there's the next panel is the beat where there's not a single word. And then the last panel where she's crying. And every now and then I say the right thing. And that's just, to me, that's, it's like Michelangelo's David. That's absolute perfection.
Yeah.
It's timed out in such a way, and this is, to me, the magic of the strip is that it's timed out in a way that a lot of other strips just can't seem to get right. You can feel the movement of time, and you can really, you really are being led by the ring in your nose by someone who understands how to stretch it and how to squeeze it, and it just is, it's difficult to describe how perfect that is in situations like strip, those particular kinds of strips. It just, to me, it's just magic. I mean, I can sit and analyze that stuff and look at it, and it just honestly means everything to me. And, you know, with regard to the work that I do with the Creative Associates on these books and stuff like that, I think the thing that I've tried to, you know, impress on everyone is it's, to me, like holding a Fabergé egg. And I don't want to do anything to mess it up. And I always beat myself up trying to do it just right. And compared to what I'm trying to work with or what I'm trying to replicate or reimagine or retell, it can't ever measure up. But I always try my very best to make it as close as I can.
That's great.
For obvious reasons.
For obvious reasons. Okay, well, I've used up close to three times as much time as I promised you I would.
Don't know what you're going to do to cut this back.
I'm not going to cut it back. There's going to be very little editing in this, I think.
You know what? That's the other thing, too, is that Jack Kirby used to say, this is a kind of a hermit career. So when someone calls and they want to talk, you find out someone's a real talkative fella.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. You know, once you start spiraling out of control, talking about individual strips.
Oh yeah, there's no end to it. I'm sure you could host your own podcast about Peanuts on a weekly basis for quite a good time to come.
Probably be, you know what, it would probably be one of those things where you're like, well, I wonder if I can get my mom to listen.
I've carefully not yet tracked how many people or who is listening out there. I'll believe it's everybody. I'll pretend. But anyway, I'm a lousy interviewer. So is there any question I didn't ask you that I should have?
I can't think of anything particularly. Nope. We're talking about Peanuts, and we're talking about specifically modern books or retellings and strips and things like that. So I think, you know, we went over my you know, career summation and likes and things. And outside of that, I mean, you know, we didn't stray too far. I wandered off into the Honeymooners, which isn't terribly shocking.
Yeah, well, I think people get the sense that some of us who are into Peanuts are pretty well versed in our pop culture in general. You know, you certainly got your Bing Crosby in there. You got your Honeymooners.
Got my little Bing Crosby in there. I talked about comic books and stuff, and obviously, you know, some of the stuff that informs, or some of the things that are most interesting about Peanuts are things that are very nearly, not black comedy, but I think it's the kind of. You know, and that comes back to the whole business with the Honeymooners. I mean, Gleason, you know, all he ever talked about was pathos. And there's a great deal of pathos in Peanuts.
Yeah.
But it's counterbalanced with incredibly silly nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And the silly stuff and the pathos, it's as close to a realistic expression as anything you can get. I mean, you simply cannot beat Charlie Brown calling the store to ask how many mini bikes they have for sale. That many? Really? How much money for a mini bike? You know, and all that sort of. I mean, that strip is just absolutely goofy, but it's near and dear, and it's as important to me as, you know, the little red-haired girl driving off and any of the stuff that's deeper or more complicated emotionally. So, now, I don't think you missed it.
Okay, well, is there any upcoming products you need to plug? You mentioned the Franklin book you're working on.
Let's see. I'm going to be finishing. I'm working on the inks right now for Nice to Meet You, Franklin. In a couple of months, I think Snoopy and Woodstock Best Friends Forever comes out. That's the one where you said it looked like Woodstock was wearing a yarmulke.
Yes. Yeah.
And it does, because I couldn't figure out how to get it strapped around his head the other way. That one's out. It's going to be fun. It's a retelling of all the strips where the birds build a nest on Snoopy's belly. And then, let's see, what else? We've got next fall, Happy Halloween, Charlie Brown, which is a new story that's based on a lot of the strips where Rerun wants to go out and trick-or-treat for a bicycle. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And then there's several other projects and some new comic books. So, yeah, lots of stuff to look forward to.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, thank you very much for taking your time here. And I will sure be in touch with you in not too long about something else entirely.
Groovy. I've enjoyed it a great deal.
Okay, take care, sir.
Take care now. Bye.
And that's it for this episode of the Og Blog Podcast. As always, I would love to hear from you. Let me know what you think of this episode. Let me know what you liked about it, didn't like about it. Let me know what you'd like to hear in future episodes. Ask me questions that I might answer in future episodes. Anything like that. Just send your comments to questions@aug.com. That's AAUGH.com. And hey, stop by the blog at blog.aug.com. We always got a lot of news there that isn't going to be covered on this particular podcast. And until next time, may your 100 peacetime civilians finally arrive in the mail. May all your little brothers love you. And may all your Greeks be good ones.